Well, happy Thanksgiving. It's Friday, November the 24th, 2006. This is the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. Dave Dickey and I have both taken the day off to spend with our families, although the markets have been open. So we'll bring you not the Closing Market Report this afternoon, but a special look at Commodity Week, which airs tomorrow. We spoke with Dan Bossi of Ag Resource out of Chicago, Illinois, while we were at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City last week. Up next, you'll hear that report in its entirety. Welcome to this special edition of Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. We're joined now on this Thanksgiving weekend by Dan Bossi, who serves as the president of Ag Resource Company out of Chicago. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Todd.
It's been an interesting time in the commodity markets, and as you view them over the long term, many people are wondering whether we're in the midst of what is either a high for the current run or whether we have more to go as we head into not only 2007 but 2008 with the development of the ethanol market, what happens to the livestock side of this market. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Todd, I equate this an awful lot to the grain embargo, rush, if you will, from the Russians back in the early 1970s, in which what happened is we shifted the price curves upwards in a lot of agricultural commodities. The Russians came forward with their hordes of gold. And for long-timers who were farming back then, we ran soybeans from $3 to $12, corn up to $4, and wheat up to $7. And I'm not saying those kind of runs are imminent right now, but I do think what is happening is that the days of cheap grain are past. I don't think I can foresee farmers collecting LDPs or contracyclical payments or those kind of things anytime in the future. And as such, the farmer needs to be more accustomed into selling these big rallies in the market. I'm not a proponent of $4 corn right now. I think when March futures make it up to $3.80 or $3.90, I'd be rewarding the market. But nonetheless, I don't see corn falling much below $3 until we make a crop next year. And so strap yourself in. This is a dynamic market that'll have lots of twists and turns. But if you're a producer, I think rewarding the market, cash and futures, makes good sense at this moment.
We made this run on a drought-ridden era in the 1990s up into that $5.40 era for corn market. But if you go back to the 1970s where you started this with, we went from $1.50 corn to $2.20 corn and really set a new era for prices. Farmers have been waiting for three decades now for another step in that marketplace. Is $3, $3.20 corn the next step? How long do we have to wait before that is really put in place? And what are the kinds of things fundamentally that the market needs to see that are there for sure to make that happen?
Well, there's several things that I look at. I think the floor on corn, as I mentioned earlier, has been brought up to, let's say, something like $3 at the moment. But we've got to be cognizant that the ethanol environment we're now in will be around for two or three or maybe even 4 years. I worry about the future in terms of cellulistic production. I think cellulistic ethanol is something that Canadians and others are looking at very strongly. I also worry about once we reach our oxygenate requirement, which I calculate to be at around 8.5-9 billion gallons in this country, who's going to utilize those extra gallons that are produced when these new plants come online in 2009? So I think there is a market for corn up in the vicinity of 8.5-9 billion gallons, but thereafter E85 or some other kind of mechanism is going to have to play a stronger role. Of course, ethanol is a very volatile fuel. We don't have a transportation infrastructure really in place right now to handle the kind of production that will be forthcoming. So there's going to be some twists and turns to the marketplace. But in a general sense, I think we as producers can all enjoy higher prices, which soon will be capitalized into land prices. We're all going to need to build more storage. And all of this is going to be somewhat of a golden era for agriculture, at least for the next 3 to 5 years. Thereafter, there's no better fertilizer than price. I think we have to be a little careful and a little cautious.
Was it good news when the president met with the big three to talk about what can be done to help them? And their suggestion was, well, make sure that alternative fuels are in the picture, and we will simply build flex fuel vehicles. And at this point, that looks like another energy and ethanol biofuel step.
I think that's right. And I think when you think about Detroit and the problems it's having with its pension funds, if we were to retool to, let's say, electric or some other kind of motive power, outside of gasoline or biofuels, it'd be very costly, and I'm not sure the auto industry could stand those costs right now. And so biofuels, if you will, is the next step to just having the companies somewhat heal up financially and then moving forward. It doesn't take a lot of money to go to a flex fuel vehicle. I think one of the problems ethanol has, however, though, is when we look at the BTUs of ethanol, of course, we only get 66% of the normal mileage. And so there's going to be some complaints about that. But in a general sense, I see no reason why ethanol, biodiesel is not around for at least 5 years. I think the farmers will enjoy this this honeymoon, if you will. But as I went to Canada just a week ago to visit with the ag ministry up there, I'm reminded that wood products and lots of other things can play into cellulosic ethanol, and really that is the push in the future. But for the next 4 or 5 years, I'm quite comfortable that starch-based ethanol will be our fuel stock and will be quite profitable for the farm community.
So in your terms, ethanol is a middle ground for a move to a more cellulosic-based fuel production alternative. And how long does it have? Does it have 10 years, 15 years on the cellulose side as opposed to the starch side, which you're looking at 3 to 4 years? And what happens to all of those ethanol plants that are planned or already in production?
We tell our ethanol clients that if they can plan for some cellulosic production in the future, it would make good sense. However, a lot of plants, of course, are just trying to get online as soon as possible, which these days, relative to permitting and the amount of water use, is becoming difficult. Nonetheless, I do think that starch-based ethanol will have a future. I mean, even if we get the cellulosic and overproduce, we'll see corn prices come down, and at that point, starch-based will have some kind of viable structure in terms of meeting demands. But if I am a new ethanol investor and looking for a plant not to come on for another year or two, I'd be rather cautious with that new investment. I think your time horizon is somewhat limited. Nonetheless, if the panacea in terms of all of this, in my mind, is somehow moving to an automobile or transportation mechanism that is based on electricity, which is the lowest price of a way of fueling an automobile and going for the first 200 miles, and then the next 200 miles being something with biofuels. So fuel security still plays very, very large in the role of this country and the denomination of the new farm policy. And I would mention that Tom Harkin is likely to be the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee, and he's been very strong on ethanol and biofuels and, of course, wrote much of the 2002 Farm Bill.
Does the corn that will be used by ethanol displace other areas? Do we increase corn production through millions of acres? What happens to the export market, which is primarily feed, and the U.S. market is also feed, half of it, livestock. Where do you see the balance coming in ethanol? And when that does come, at what level do we put a cash price?
Well, the market right now is trying to encourage U.S. farmers to plant at least another 5 to 7 million acres next year. Just to meet existing facilities that will be coming online and to, of course, service the big traditional users, which, of course, livestock producers. The U.S. consumes on a feed residual basis about 6 billion bushels of corn each year. We calculate that residual to be somewhere around 850 or 900 million bushels. And so just think of it this way. For each penny move in corn is about $5 million to the U.S. livestock industry. So the dollar rally is take $5 billion out of their pocket. That's something we need to be aware of, and ultimately it's going to produce liquidation of some herds, of the marginal herds, and we think will cause consumer prices for meat products and other things to rise in 12 to 18 months as the smaller numbers are pulled forward and corn prices are not going to decline anytime soon. And so it is very important not only to bring in an additional 5 million acres over the next couple of years, but somehow we've got to get the technology companies improving yield. We calculate that Monsanto continues to need to do its job in terms of building yield, drought-tolerant corn, things of that nature that will lift U.S. corn yields from 160 or 156 as we calculate the trend line now, maybe up to 165 or 170 if ethanol is really to be the sustainable crop we think it could be.
Where will the corn acres come? Will they come in the Midwest displacing soybean acres? Will they displace cotton acres in the South? How do those acres come into this marketplace?
Well, right now, I think based on relationships, you are going to see maybe a million and a half acres come from cotton. cotton prices have not participated in this last ag rally. We're still trading 47 to 49 cents a pound, and at least in our client base, there's a lot of cotton farmers that are going to be planting corn next year. I think you're also going to see some acres come from soybeans. We're estimating 3.5 million acres there. So right here today, current prices in our work suggest that 4.5 to 5 million acres will be available for additional corn production next spring. I think we still, the market still has to buy another 1 million or 2 acres. Whether that comes from hayland, there's a very strong correlation between 350 new crop corn futures and 2 or 3 million acres of hay leaving the program. The U.S. plants about 62 million acres or harvests about 62 million acres of hay each year. These are the kind of dynamics that will play out. I would also tell you that if we look at the U.S. total crop farm base, there's 315 to 318 million acres. Those includes crops like sunflower and rapeseed and cotton and all the various small grains. We tend to find when prices are high that we somehow find another million and a half being planted that was either laying fallow or wasn't being farmed. And so adding it all together, we think we'll make it this year. The real hard part comes in finding that 5 or 6 million acres in 2008. That's where the market really has a job to do.
Will Congress help that process along by what they do with the next farm bill? You talked about cotton acres and those potentially going away. Step 2 program has been eliminated through the WTO. The South is not so dependent upon the cotton production and its ability to produce shirts and other sorts of things out of the textile industry anymore. You suggested that hay acres could come into corn. That would put some pressure on the dairy industry and could all wind up as places that Congress might find easy to cut out of the farm programs.
Well, I think that's right. I think the big challenge for agriculture in this new farm bill will be holding our baseline budget. I think it's going to be very difficult for U.S. farmers to expect the same kind of economic incentives in this farm bill that they've seen before. Nonetheless, the big question going forward in my mind is how many of those CRP acres will be coming back at us? Will some leave the program, and will Congress make it easier to leave the program? Right now, the USDA secretary is suggesting that those CRP acres are not needed for the biofuel industry. I'm not so sure about that. I think as we look towards 2008, as many plants coming online as we think, and we start talking about 9 or 10 billion gallons of production, that we'll need another 3 to 5 million acres from the CRP. But heretofore, it's really about raising yields, and it's about somehow expanding the overall landmass in agriculture. I'm seeing a tremendous interest from the money funds out of New York, the hedge funds in particular, to throw lots of money into farm production agriculture, let's just say buying a farmland and building new facilities. We'll see if that makes up the difference. But the chore ahead is monstrous, and the market has a real job to do. Someday I'm confident with any kind of weather scare we will make it to $4.50 or $5 corn and reach us that mid-1990s highs. But at those kind of incentives that are needed to really get the acreage back into production that we're talking about. And for the livestock guy, it's just going to be difficult for him to manage. Unless meat prices rise significantly, he's going to be looking at several years of reduced profitability, particularly on the cow-calf side.
I have a series of questions on the investment money that's available out of New York, out of Los Angeles, out of Chicago, and where it might go. To some extent, it has gone into the markets directly at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Kansas City Board of Trade. More recently, some of that money has gone into the development of ethanol production facilities. Some of it has always gone into farmland, but not much. Will they be happier putting money directly into the marketplace, or will they find that more volatile than they want it to be, and will they look for harder assets over time? And what happens to the market if that's the case, as funds begin to pull out of the commodity markets and look for something safer and less volatile?
Yeah, I think this all goes in stages, at least from me sitting in a position where we are seeing this New York money coming at us over the last year and a half. First of all, it went into the commodity market, corn, soybeans, and wheat, the commodity itself. Then we saw a real interest in building or the securing of ethanol facilities. That was really in the first half of this year, where hedge funds were quite interested in making those acquisitions. Now we're finding that the hedge funds really want to own the land itself. They see the benefit forthcoming of whether it's cellulistic or ethanol from starch-based components, and they want to participate in what they see as a 20 to 40% appreciation of farmland values. course, the limiting factor in all of this is going to be their ability to invest large sums in tracks and having various managers. It's just, how do you invest $100 million in farmland? You don't find 70,000 acres in one track anymore, and this is what they're coming up against.
Will they eventually find in the heartland of America that they will be rebuffed, probably politically at the state level or at the federal level on school funding grounds, on the idea that owning a piece of property and farmland is actually very democratic, where owning a large piece of tract of land under a fund may not be part of our democracy? How long do they have, and will there be a political will at some point to shift that investment someplace else?
Well, it's like apple pie. I mean, that's what we're talking about here in family farms and a way of life that goes back to, of course, when we all segued from 160 acres from the government. I'm not sure, but I will say this, that I do have some farmers calling and asking me whether their money is as green as anybody else's. And so if they're willing to pay the premiums in the market of several hundred dollars an acre to attract tracks that are next to each other, they may have some success. Right now, they seem to be focusing not so much in the heartland of the Midwest, but they're looking at maybe buying CRP acres, buying land in the Dakotas or western Nebraska where there is some irrigation. I've even had some interest up in Saskatchewan where you can put big tracts of land together, and the Soros Fund recently bought a big chunk of land down in Argentina. So it is not only in the United States, this is really a global phenomena, and whether they're successful or not, I think depends quite acutely on the ability to hire good talent. By that I'm saying farm manager and the managers and the management that goes behind it. But I still think agriculture is still an opportunistic business that is rewarding for scale. And by scale, I'm talking a few thousand acres, not the thousands of acres that these guys would like to accumulate.
Does much of this depend on what happens in the Middle East in terms of how much oil they're willing to produce, at what level? And I've often wondered if anybody has a good handle on what their capacity to produce or pump on a given day might be, as opposed to what the refining capacity around the globe might be. So if they wanted to, could they just turn on the spigot and fill the land with oil and eliminate the process of alternative fuels?
I don't know if they could eliminate it, but let's look at it this way, Todd. We consume about 143 gallons of gasoline, 143 billion gallons of gasoline in this country. We're going from producing something short of 2 billion gallons of ethanol, and we're ramping up very close to 10 billion in a matter of 3 years. And so, you know, if you take 10 billion compared to 143, it's not a large amount. But then when we look at what high prices have done to stimulate the stripper fields, all these other kinds of alternative investments, I do think it has a play. And I do think that the crude oil market, unless we have more hurricanes through the Gulf or something from a very natural resource kind of phenomena occur, that the crude oil highs are probably in. What we don't know is this Simmons theory. Have we reached peak oil? Are we at peak production? That is supposed to occur sometime around 2010, 2012, but no one seems to know for sure. That will really determine whether or not these alternative fuels are viable over a multi-decade kind of scenario. I think OPEC is showing at the moment that they have, of course, started to restrict production, something they hadn't done for the past couple of years. There is excess capacity out there, and so I do think there will be pressures on the crude oil market, but it really takes a crude oil price below $40 before a lot of the ethanol guys start losing money.
Will 350 corn on the Board of Trade on a regular basis cause corn to come into production in China, in Ukraine, in other areas of the globe, offsetting either export markets for the United States or potentially providing an import market that might allow the U.S. to import corn for ethanol production on the coasts, for instance?
Yeah, it's, you know, as we stated earlier, there's no better fertilizer in agriculture than high prices. Of course, the problem with corn is that it can only be produced in certain areas of the globe. The United States, of course, being the biggest producer, China number two, followed by Argentina. They produce a little corn in South Africa and Ukraine, but it's really not a crop that lends itself to widespread production in Europe or Russia or even places of the Cerrados in Brazil. So I do think you will see elevated yields, new lands coming into production. That's what this is all about. Over time, that will be the response of the market. But we also need to remember that before the biofuel revolution, global corn demand was increasing rather dramatically on its own right, just from the increase in disposable income from Southeast Asia and the Eastern Europeans having a bigger appetite for meat. And so global livestock herds are record large right now. Biofuels is just kind of piling on, so I still think there's demand for corn. It's not going to leave us soon, and it's going to be difficult in places like China where they have a limited arable land supply really to expand beyond increasing yield.
The one kind of, let's flip that around and talk just a bit about soybeans as we wrap up this conversation, because soybeans can be grown in a lot of places around the globe and grown quite successfully, unlike corn, which the United States far and away outproduces even its second closest competitor, which is China. South America produces just as much as the United States. China does a really good job of producing soybean at this time. This has been a follower in the market as ethanol has taken the lead role in corn, and wheat was in that role for a while under conditions where it just simply wasn't available. What happens to the soybean market, and do biofuels develop for it along as with this alternative fuel push?
Well, we have a new biodiesel capacity increasing by about 1.4 billion gallons in the next 12 to 14 months. Significant increase. I think we need to remember that ethanol has had subsidies going back to 1986. Biodiesel subsidies only started being offered in 2005, so it's an industry that is still in its infancy and being built out. The investment in biodiesel is not as great as in ethanol, but nonetheless, you only get 11.5 pounds of soybean oil per bushel of beans. And so when we start talking about numbers of billions of gallons and there's 7.5 pounds of biodiesel potentially in each gallon of biodiesel, the numbers add up quite quickly. And so if these new plants come online as we expect, the U.S. really needs to bring on crush capacity for soybeans about another 350 million bushels. And so it's a 1-2 punch. I would mention to you, as I've just gotten back from Switzerland and other places in the world, that biodiesel is really the fuel of other countries across the ponds, if you will. I mean, you look at China or Malaysia, if you look at Europe, it is biodiesel, a lot of it rape and canola oil, which is fueling the advances. And so the Europeans are using 6.5 million metric tons of biodiesel. It is a well-accepted fuel at the moment, and so it is their way of looking forward. I think the poor countries of India and some of the other big veg oil importers are going to have difficulty obtaining supply to meet the caloric intakes of their country going forward. This is something that I think is an adverse effect of the biofuel revolution, but don't be fooled. Biodiesel is really the sleeping giant when we think about it on a global perspective.
One final question. Because it seems that you believe ethanol from corn is a shorter-term answer, which has most potential over the long term, 5, 10, 15 years, to become the lead crop around the globe?
I really think it is biodiesel. I think it is vegetable oils. I think it is canola, sun, and those crops that really produce the high oil content. And that can be raised in so many areas. I mean, Brazil still has 77 to 80 million acres of land that could be brought into production for these biofuels. And so in my work, it is really biodiesel, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the sleeping giant that will awaken and I think provide the impetus for higher oilseed prices years to come.
Thank you, Dan.
You're very welcome, Todd.
Dan Bossi is the president of Ag Resource out of Chicago, Illinois. We caught up with him November the 15th, that's a Wednesday of last week, while we're at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. Dave Dickey and I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving weekend.